I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. Look, I do not like taking care of my lawn. I abuse my hose. I drag it all over the asphalt driveway. I tug it this way. I tug it that way. But the Pocket Hose Ballistic handles it all. This hose has changed my landscaping life. It's the toughest pocket hose ever built, reinforced with liquid crystal polymer used in bulletproof vests, something I know a little bit about. It's super lightweight, easy to manage, easy to store, and when you want to use it, you turn the water on, it grows, and then when you turn the water off, it shrinks back down to pocket size. Pretty self-explanatory. It also comes with the pocket pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. You move, it follows, and the water flows. And listen, I'm sure there are some of you saying, Derek, it's just a hose. But the pocket hose carries over 100 patents worldwide. So this isn't your typical hose. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase a new Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle. Just text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
In the early morning hours of August 13th, 2005, 13-year-old Alex Anaya vanished from her home in Hammond, Indiana, just outside of Chicago. For weeks, her family was left wondering where she was and whether she was okay. They searched for answers, hoping Alex would come home. Then on September 7th, they got the news that no family wants to hear. Alex had been found. She had been the victim of a horrific crime that would leave her family and community in shock. Nearly 21 years later, her murder remains unsolved, leaving everyone asking the same question: what kind of monster could do something like this? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, so we're going to talk about Alex's case tonight, and there's going to be one person of interest that we're going to talk about, and then I'm going to go over a couple other theories, but I do want to say that tonight is going to be a little different than what we normally do. You may not love everything I have to say, but I have made a career out of being honest, even when I knew the people that were going to be hearing the information wouldn't like it. And I've always said to people off record, on record, I'd rather you hate me for who I am than love me for who I'm not. And so I have made it a practice to not tell you what you want to hear, but tell you what I truly think. And I've always suggested that to you guys as well. So on that note, I will say that if Alex's mother, Sandra, is listening or watching right now, just out of respect, this may not be an episode you want to hear. Now, if you can handle it, by all means, I have no problem saying it to you. And if you do watch or hear this and you want to talk more about it, I'd be happy to hop on a call. But based on everything that I've gathered, I have some issues. I have some issues with your decisions, and I do think they contribute to why I'm having to talk about Alex in this way and why we are where we are right now. So again, I'm going to go over it all. We definitely have a lot to get into. So let's dive into this week's case. Alexandra Anaya, who went by Alex, was born on February 10, 1992 to her mother, Sandra. She was raised in the Chicago area where she was known as loving and caring, and she always had a smile on her face and loved giving hugs. Sandra raised Alex as a single mother for the first part of her childhood. Then in the mid-1990s, when Alex was approximately 4 years old, Sandra began dating her neighbor, and his name was Rudolfo Heredia. But he went by Rudy, and Sandra and Rudy went on to welcome two daughters together. And by April of 2005, not long after Alex had turned 13 years old, the relationship came to an end. Sandra, Alex, and her twins moved to a home located at 4815 Pine Avenue in Hammond, Indiana, which is just outside of Chicago. By the late summer of 2005, Alex was still 13 years old and attending Clark Middle School. She played volleyball, soccer, and ran cross country. According to those close to her, she loved music, especially Britney Spears and Usher. Alex also loved animals and hoped to become a veterinarian someday. At this time, her twin sisters were 6 years old, and with Rudy no longer in the picture, Sandra was once again raising the girls on her own. So Alex, at 13 years old, stepped into the role of second mother. One of her sisters later told Crime Stoppers Case Files that Alex was the one who was around most of the time. She watched them while Sandra was gone, made meals for them, and helped with their homework. By all accounts, the siblings were very close, and it wasn't uncommon for Alex to spend weekends at home instead of with her friends. On the night of Friday, August 12, 2005, Alex stayed home with her mom and her sisters. The family ate dinner together, and after the twins were asleep, Sandra left for a date, leaving Alex home with the girls. At approximately 3:30 a.m. on what was now August 13th, Sandra returned home. Alex was still awake. She was wearing navy blue plaid pajama pants and a red Echo shirt. The two sat down and they had White Castle slider sandwiches together. They also had French fries, which is going to be important in the story later. Now, while they were sitting down eating their sliders and fries, Alex let her mom know that Rudy, the ex-boyfriend, had called the house. And at that time, Sandra says, "Yeah, I know. He tried calling my cell phone as well." The one thing I will note here is I don't know if either of them spoke to Rudy. I don't know if they picked up the calls. I have to imagine that Sandra did not pick up the phone while she was on a date. I don't know if Alex did. I would assume that she didn't. And when we get into Rudy and his past behaviors and his relationship with Alex, I think you'll understand why, more than likely, Alex did not pick up the phone. It may have been a voicemail or maybe it was caller ID. Now, about an hour later at 4:30 a.m., after having their burgers and fries and talking for a little bit, Sandra left the house again. And I want to stop right there because that's odd to me. And I don't understand what's going on there. I'm going to get into it more in the perspective. But as far as I can tell, I've watched numerous YouTube episodes, done some research, looked online. I haven't seen an interview where Sandra has explained where she went at 4:30 a.m. I believe that she left. There's no doubt about it. But if I had the opportunity to sit down with Sandra and speak to her, I would want to know where she went, who she was with, and why she decided to leave at 4:30 a.m. Hell, why did you come home at 3:30 if you were just going to leave at 4:30? Was that planned? Was it unintentional? Did something come up? I need more information. I need to know exactly what happened and why you left. Now, I will say this. Unless it was some type of emergency, I'll tell you right now, I don't agree with it. I don't even agree with you coming home at 3:30 in the morning, leaving your 13-year-old home alone with 2 6-year-old girls. But again, we'll dive more into that and how it affects this case. But leaving again after getting home at 4:30 in the morning, again, leaving your kids home alone, don't agree with it. And as you'll see, it created this window where there was no adult supervision. So moving on, Sandra leaves the house and she returns at approximately 6:45 a.m. and she immediately knew something was wrong. The front door was unlocked and Alex was gone. Sandra searched outside for her but could not find her anywhere. So she contacted the police, but according to Sandra, she was told that Alex was probably with a friend or something like that, and she would eventually come home. I do want to note that in one of the interviews that I watched, Sandra did say at this point a police report was taken. She specifically describes the conversation as them asking for her age, her height, her obviously her name. And so I do believe that a report was filed over the phone. But then after that, they probably said, hey, give it a few hours, let us know, and then either call back or we'll follow up. Obviously, that wasn't done. You can decide whether you agree with that move or not. Do I think law enforcement should have came out with a 13-year-old girl missing? Absolutely. But I do need more context because I do wonder if Alex was already in the system. Was this something that happened before? Why was the decision made not to go out to the residence to ensure that maybe she had just taken off for a few hours? Overall, I do believe a police report was taken. I don't think she was entered into NCIC, but there was at least some initial documentation of Alex not being home. And so after speaking with law enforcement and filing that police report, Sandra and the twins got into the car and began looking for Alex themselves. They drove around searching for her, but they couldn't find her, so they returned home and started making calls. But again, no one had seen or heard from Alex. The family waited, hoping that Alex would eventually come back, but she never did. So on Monday morning, Sandra went to the police department in person and reported that Alex still had not returned home. And again, going back to some of the interviews that I watched, Sandra says that she goes in there. She basically says, hey, Alex still hasn't returned home. I thought someone was going to follow up with me. Nobody ever did. And so there's maybe a miscommunication there because from my understanding and just, you know, my history with doing these types of cases, I would have went out there, but I would also rely on the parent to communicate with me saying, hey, listen, if they haven't been home in a couple hours, call back again. If they're not home by tomorrow, you absolutely need to call us. We're usually not sitting by the phone following up because if we haven't heard from you, we're going to assume that she hasn't come home. So I'm not defending law enforcement here. There absolutely should and could have been a follow-up. And maybe there was a miscommunication on the phone where the initial report taker said, hey, we're going to take this initial report. If you don't hear from her by tonight or tomorrow, please call us back so we can escalate this investigation. Whatever the case may be, this is the timeline we're dealing with. And I think it's important for you guys to have a correct understanding of what transpired and how many days had passed. So after Sandra leaves the police station, an investigator later came to the house to take a report and also speak with the neighbors. And according to several reports, multiple people told the police that they had seen Alex in the early morning hours of August 13th, and she was with an adult white male driving a red car, possibly a four-door Toyota. And from some other reports that I saw, she may have been in the passenger seat of that vehicle. And from all the information I've gathered, including a report from the Times, Sandra was asked about this guy, this description, this vehicle, and apparently she had no idea who the man could have been. The car didn't sound familiar, neither did the description. So the search for Alex continued, but there was no sign of her anywhere. Then, on Tuesday, August 16th, the investigator assigned to Alex's case saw something on television that immediately caught his attention. We're going to talk about it right after the break. Hey, guess who the next sponsor is? It's a regular here on Detective Perspective. I'm talking about Smalls. They make fresh, human-grade food for cats, and it's made from the same stuff that you or I would eat, but formulated specifically to help cats thrive. And we're going to change it up a bit and play a little game of false or fact. So first question, false or fact, the ingredients in most grocery store cat food is water and corn. That's a fact. Most cat food is filled with just water and fillers. False or fact, some cat food brands use the same meat grade you'd find in a hot dog. That's also a fact. 4D meat from dead, dying, deceased, or disabled animals is technically legal in pet food. False or fact, a bag of cat food labeled natural has zero legal definition behind it. Unfortunately, that is a fact as well. Natural is largely unregulated in the pet food industry. So this is all scary, but it's the truth, and that's why I wanted to discuss it with you. High-quality food is an investment in your cat's health. We all know that vet bills can rack up into the thousands of dollars, but when you feed them better food like Smalls, it may help offset some of those bills. It's because Smalls' fresh, gently cooked food is made without preservatives, and a balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and more silky shine on that fur coat. Smalls cat food leads to high protein and improved hydration. That equals strong bones and toned muscles. Cats use protein as their main source of energy, so more protein means more fuel and sustained energy. And it's not just the customers that are raving about Smalls. Forbes ranked Smalls the best overall cat food. So stop serving your little carnivores a bowl of processed shortcuts. For a limited time, because you are a Detective Perspective listener or viewer, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head over to smalls.com/detective. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/detective. Okay, so we're back, and the detective assigned to Alex's case is at home or at work, and he's watching TV, and a news segment was reporting that human remains had been found approximately 15 minutes away from where Alex lived in the Little Calumet River near 135th Street and Indiana Avenue. This was close to the border of Chicago and Riverdale. Before we get into exactly what was found, I want to walk you through a map of this area. So if you're watching on video right now, you can see this map. And on the afternoon of August 16th, boaters made a horrific discovery in the Little Calumet River. While in the area we just talked about, they found the naked torso of a female victim. The remains had been wrapped in heavy chains and fastened to concrete before being submerged in the water. The victim's head, arms, and legs below the knee were missing, and because of that, investigators could not immediately identify who she was. Police did search the area extensively, hoping to recover the rest of the remains, but unfortunately, they were never found. And that could mean a couple things. On one hand, the remains may have been there and they just missed them. Or, just based on the measures we know the suspect took to hide the torso with the chains and the concrete, they may have gone a little bit further and actually discarded the body parts in different locations intentionally. Either way, you're in a tough spot here, and you know at this point, this wasn't an accident, this was an intentional, and unfortunately, whoever this woman was, she suffered a horrific death. And I do want to note that if you look this up, or if you're on YouTube, you're going to see a photo of investigators removing the torso from the water in what appears to be a big body bag, but the body bag was not in the water. That was used to transport the torso from the river to the medical examiner's office. I don't want you to sit here and think that when they found the body, it was inside this duffel bag. That is not the case. And speaking of the medical examiner's office, an autopsy on the torso concluded that the victim had been raped prior to her murder. Investigators also determined that the limbs had been removed with what was described as, quote, clean cuts. But beyond that, there were very few answers. The medical examiner could not determine the victim's exact cause of death. And at that point, all investigators knew for certain was that the victim was female and that she had been raped, murdered, and dismembered. Most importantly, they didn't know who she was. So Chicago detectives began comparing missing persons reports, hoping to identify their Jane Doe. Meanwhile, investigators working Alex's case just over the state line in Hammond, Indiana, saw this news segment about the Jane Doe and immediately wondered if it could be Alex. So they contacted the Chicago Police Department. They shared the details they had so far, including one finding that stood out. Investigators had found undigested French fries in the victim's stomach. Knowing Alex had eaten White Castle shortly before she disappeared, the investigators working the case believed there was a strong chance that the victim could be her. Chicago police then contacted Sandra and asked her to provide a DNA sample. She agreed, and the sample was sent off for comparison testing. But Sandra was adamant that the victim could not be Alex. She could not imagine her daughter being dead, let alone the victim of such a heinous crime. Because DNA testing would take a couple weeks, investigators continued treating Alex as a missing person, and no public connection was made between Alex and the victim found in the Little Calumet River. On August 20th, 1 week after Alex was last seen, Sandra and investigators went to the media asking for help. Police told reporters, quote, "We're concerned. She has a decent relationship with her mom. There's no evidence they were fighting, so the circumstances are unusual." Sandra also said she had no reason to believe that Alex had run away. She told reporters, quote, "I don't know what's got her upset. We haven't argued, and we've been getting along okay. I've been trying to figure out what happened. Maybe I'm looking too deep into this, but you and I, everyone listening or watching this episode right now, we've covered a lot of cases, a lot of missing persons cases, missing children cases. And I haven't recalled a case where the mom or dad has come out and said, we were getting along okay. And I'm sure there are some. I don't think this is, you know, the first time this has ever happened. But when I hear that, to me, it sounds like maybe there has been some trouble in the relationship where they weren't always okay or on the best terms. But at this particular point, they were getting along. They were fine. They were okay. That's not usually what we hear from the parents. When something like this happens, they come out and they are adamant about the fact that they had a great relationship with their child and they would never leave. This doesn't sound like that to me, but maybe I'm looking too deep into it. Pause the episode. Let me know what you think. And so after that public announcement, things grew quiet for a little bit because investigators had to wait for the DNA results. But finally, on September 7th, there was an answer. But it wasn't the one that anyone was hoping for. The remains found in the Little Calumet River belonged to 13-year-old Alex Anaya. The lead detective later said that Sandra completely fell apart when she learned the news. According to this detective, quote, she went down on her knees and crawled on the floor, crying and screaming, just lost it. And this is where I sometimes struggle between the balance of being a detective and being a parent. On one hand, I want to be honest with you guys and I want to be direct about what I feel. On the other hand, I feel for Sandra and I sympathize with her and I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. And I want to be abundantly clear here. I do not believe that Sandra had anything to do with what happened to Alex. But I do believe that some of her decisions created an environment where something like this could happen. So we'll talk about it more, but let me just say, Sandra, if you did make it this far, I don't agree with everything you did, but I'm sorry you went through this. Nobody should have to experience this. No parent should have to learn that their child is dead, especially in this way. And hearing that from the detective, I couldn't help but feel for you. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry you went through that. With Alex now confirmed to be the victim found in Chicago, the case was transferred to the homicide unit and the FBI also joined the investigation. Alex's family continued speaking to the media, but this time they were more open about what they believe may have happened. According to the family, they suspected from the very beginning that Alex had been taken by someone she knew. They alleged that the person had, quote, harmed her in the past, but there was no report made. At the time, no names were publicly mentioned, but it would later become clear they were referring to Rudy, Sandra's former boyfriend and father of the twins. Sandra told investigators that Rudy was a bad person, and that was ultimately what led to their breakup in April of 2005. Sandra said that shortly before the breakup, Alex told her that Rudy had been molesting her for the past 6 years. And that would make her about 7 years old when this started. So basically the entire time that he had been around Alex. After learning that information, Sandra ended the relationship, but the breakup was not easy. She alleged that Rudy was violent and abusive and described him as a man with no regard for his actions. Sandra said Rudy even threatened to kill her if she left. Despite all of that, Sandra moved forward with the breakup and relocated with the girls to the home on Pine Avenue, the same home that Alex disappeared from. But according to Sandra, Rudy would not let it go. She told investigators he stalked both her and Alex, followed them around, showed up at the house, and climbed on nearby structures to look into the home. She also claimed he broke into the house multiple times and secretly made a copy of the house key. When Sandra realized he had a key, she changed the locks, but Rudy continued showing up anyway. Sandra said that multiple neighbors had witnessed Rudy spying on them. However, she never reported those incidents to the police, which meant that there was no documentation backing up those claims. As a detective, as a parent, as, you know, no matter what world you come from, not the right move. Like, I respect the fact that you got out of there, but what are we thinking? I just don't get it. I just don't get what we're doing here. And first off, as soon as your child comes forward and tells you that they're being molested by another person. I don't give a shit who it is. You report it to the police. That's number one. Number two, if for some reason you don't report it, which I completely disagree with, if you separate from this person and they refuse to leave you alone, you report it. Because as you can see from what I'm describing to you guys, it's only getting worse. There's clearly escalation here. So how long are you going to wait, Sandra? What has to happen before you act? I don't know what's in her head, and I don't know what would make her believe that this was just going to go away, but she should have contacted the police as soon as Alex made her aware of what was going on. And maybe if she had, none of the other things that I described right now would have occurred. So based on all this information that investigators were now learning about Rudy, they began looking into his background. And very quickly, they realized that he lived at East 138th Street in Riverdale, which borders Chicago. Why is that important? Well, his home was only a half a mile away from where Alex's remains had been found. With that information, investigators obtained a warrant to search Rudy's house, which authorities described to the media as, quote, a possible crime scene. They spent hours inside collecting evidence, though they have never publicly shared what had been recovered. While the search was happening, Rudy was brought in for questioning. During that interview, he admitted to following Sandra and Alex after the breakup in April. According to investigators, Rudy also said he watched Sandra through her bedroom window from a nearby rooftop and entered the home using a key he had secretly copied. But Rudy denied having anything to do with Alex's murder. And even though the police didn't believe him, they did not have enough evidence to charge him with her murder. They also didn't want to simply release him. So instead, Rudy was arrested on the federal offense he had allegedly admitted to during questioning, crossing state lines for the purpose of harassing or intimidating Sandra. Prosecutors later added an additional charge of residential burglary based on the statement that he had entered Sandra's home without permission. Months later, in January of 2006, Rudy went to trial on the harassment and burglary charges, but prosecutors faced major challenges from the start. They were not allowed to mention Alex or tell jurors that the investigators believed Rudy could be connected to her murder. In the end, Rudy was found not guilty on all charges. Sandra later said she was heartbroken by the outcome. And this is unfortunate, but if all you have is his statements during an interview, I don't know if they were recorded, but you could claim duress. You could claim not understanding the questioning. There's a lot that goes on there without having physical evidence and without having a report initially from Sandra. I could tell before even reading the rest of this that it was going to be a problem. His omission alone is not enough in most cases, because obviously he's going to go back and say, I didn't say it. So if there's not actual documentation in the form of a video or audio, you basically got nothing. And you would need some physical evidence to get a federal offense across like this, because that's a significant charge, and the judge is going to want more than just, oh, he said he did it during an interview. After Rudy's acquittal, media attention surrounding Alex's case began to fade. Years passed with very few public updates. Behind the scenes, however, investigators continued working the case. From everything that I've learned, detectives never officially shelved it, but they were also not uncovering any major developments, so there wasn't much they could do. Then, in August of 2016, 11 years after Alex was killed, there was finally an update. The FBI and the Chicago police announced that Alex's case had been reassigned to the FBI's Homicide Initiative Task Force. According to investigators, the goal was to re-examine the case from a fresh perspective and apply new forensic techniques. And we're going to talk about it right after the break. These days, everybody's talking about weight loss injections because the results are so dramatic. They work by lowering blood sugar and reducing appetite. So what if you're looking to lose weight but not interested in painful weekly injections, especially when you hear about all those intense side effects? That's why doctors created a weight loss supplement called Lean, and the results are remarkable. The studied ingredients in Lean have shown to lower your blood sugar, burn fat by converting it into energy, and curb your appetite and cravings so you're not as hungry. But listen, Lean is not for your casual dieter, so if you only have a few pounds to lose, this isn't for you. The doctors at Brickhouse Nutrition created Lean for frustrated dieters who are looking to lose 10 pounds or more. So let's get you started with 20% off and free Rush shipping so you can add Lean to your healthy diet and exercise plan. Visit TakeLean.com and enter Detective for your discount. That's promo code Detective at TakeLean.com. Let's talk about the world's number one expanding garden hose, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. I've talked to you about the trials and tribulations that I've had with my lawn and dealing with the old hoses that were connected to my house when I first bought it. Absolute trash. So this sponsor came along. I was sent a 25-foot pocket hose ballistic, tried it, fell in love with it, bought an additional one that was 75 feet, and I've been using them every other day. I'm trying to grow some grass seed in certain spots that my sprinklers don't hit, and that's why I needed the 75-foot hose, and it's doing the job. Not only that, I love that I don't have to go out there and uncoil it every day. All I do, turn on the water, the hose expands, and then after I'm done, turn it off, leave the nozzle open, and it shrinks right back down to pocket size. And I have it actually hidden in my mulch bed, so I've been a little lazy where I just shut the water off, let it run out, and walk away. And the time I come out the next day, the hose is just all coiled up right there on the mulch, ready to use. I absolutely love it. And this thing is literally bulletproof because, like I said, I just turn it off. It starts to coil up, so it's being dragged through rocks, through dirt, through the driveway, the grass, and then onto the mulch. Not a single nick in it. And that's because it has a liquid crystal polymer inside of it, which is the same material used in bulletproof vests, which, as a former cop, you know I absolutely love. And this thing's filled with technology. It has over 100 patents. It's easy to store. It's lightweight. And like I just said, it's pocket size. You really can't beat it. Plus, it comes with the pocket hose pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. So whatever direction you go, it's not going to end up wrapping around the spigot. You go one way, the hose follows. It's pretty self-explanatory. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase a new pocket hose ballistic, you'll get the pocket pivot for free. Plus, you're going to get a free thumb drive nozzle, which I'm also using on both hoses. All you have to do is text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. Okay, we're back. And as I was mentioning before the break, the case was now assigned to the FBI's Homicide Initiative Task Force. And detectives began reviewing all the evidence again, which they said had been well-preserved, which is good to hear. Items were sent to the FBI for testing using updated forensic technology, but investigators did not publicly say exactly what evidence was tested, and as far as I can tell, no result from that testing has ever been publicly shared. Investigators also started re-interviewing witnesses and reviewing old case files to see if anything had been missed. During that process, detectives publicly shared a detail that had not been previously released. Alex wore the same necklace every day. It was a gold chain with a medallion stamped with the face of Jesus. But the necklace has never been recovered. It was not found with Alex's remains, and it was not located at her home. So investigators began to wonder if the person responsible for her murder may have kept it as a trophy. They released a photo of this necklace and asked the public if anyone had seen it. Unfortunately, no one came forward, but I wanted to throw that in here and throw that photo up because maybe someone out there has seen it who hasn't come forward yet. And although there's probably more than one of this necklace, it's pretty specific. So if by chance you're from that area and you've seen a necklace similar to this, I definitely think you should report it. Investigators also shared that they believed Alex may have known the person who killed her. However, when reporters asked specifically about Rudy, they declined to comment. After this announcement, the task force continued working on Alex's case, but by 2018, nearly 2 years later, they still had not made the progress they had hoped for. At that point, authorities announced a $10,000 reward for information and released a public statement sharing a bit more about what they believe happened to Alex, stating, quote, "Her death was not a random act of violence." And I completely agree with this statement. In fact, it's kind of commonsensical if you really think about it. It's 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. Alex wasn't going out for a jog or a walk. She wasn't just ran up on by some random stranger who happened to see her out. One of two things happened here. This person came to the home and Alex let them inside, or Alex left the home and went for a joyride. We're going to talk about both of those angles in the perspective. The following year, Sandra spoke to the Chicago Tribune to mark 14 years since Alex was killed. Sandra said she knows who's responsible, but there's not enough evidence to prove it. Sandra said she trusted investigators and believed they were doing everything they could. She still held on to the hope that one day there would be enough evidence to bring murder charges or that someone would eventually come forward and confess. She went on to say that she wanted answers not only for herself, but also for Alex's siblings, who still had lingering questions about what happened. The next major update in the case came in May of 2023, and by then, nearly 18 years had passed since Alex was killed. At that time, the FBI announced that they were doubling the reward, increasing it to $20,000. But despite that, no new information came forward. Unfortunately, that is the last public update in Alex's case. Her murder remains unsolved, and no suspects have ever been publicly named. But Alex's family and investigators are still fighting for her, hoping to one day reveal the identity of her killer. All right, so let's dive into this perspective. There's a few things I want to cover, and I'm going to start right off the rip with Rudy. Rudy's a scumbag. If anything that's being reported is true regarding what he did to Alex, absolute scumbag, should not be out walking free. I will say, just for legal purposes, he has never been charged with a crime and nothing was reported. So as far as we're concerned, he's innocent and nobody should take matters into their own hands. But if this is true, he's an absolute monster and I got nothing good to say about him. That being said, we're talking about Alex's murder. And I want to break that down a little bit more regarding Rudy, because I think we can all see that her torso being found so close to his home is a red flag. It's not good. But I don't want you guys to lose sight of the fact that it could just be an unfortunate coincidence for Rudy. So let's dive into that a little bit. First off, there are multiple reports, not just one, that Alex was seen on the morning of August 13th with a white male in a red Toyota. She was in the passenger seat. From everything that I can find, and there's not much, I don't believe Rudy owned a red Toyota. More importantly, I cannot find a picture of this guy. If you have it, kudos to you. I want to hire you because I can't find it. I've watched the YouTube videos. I looked online. There's nothing. But it's my belief, based on the color of his twin daughter's skin, that he wasn't a Caucasian. He wasn't white. So the person that's being described by several witnesses in this red Toyota, more than likely it's not Rudy. More importantly, if any of this is true, which, by the way, I think the stalking stuff is definitely true, right? Allegedly, he admitted to it. And he had called multiple times that night. I don't think Alex would have voluntarily let him in. Clearly, there were problems there. And clearly, based on their relationship, she wasn't very fond of him. So I don't see her waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, going to the door and unlocking it without looking to see who it is. And then realizing it's Rudy, I don't think she's opening the door. I think she's calling her mom. And yet that's not what happened. So although Rudy doesn't look good on the surface and he has a very checkered past and questionable behavior, it doesn't mean he killed Alex. And if he went to this home, there's no way for him to know exactly who was there. But even if the door was accidentally left unlocked by Alex or Sandra, or she did come down and for some reason unlocked it to let him inside, she's not going to leave with him. She's not going to take off and leave her twin sisters at home for Rudy. So there's a lot of questions here. And I will say, with him being such a prime target, if there was something to connect him to this crime between the Hammond Police Department, the Chicago Police Department, the FBI, they would have found it. They would have pinned it on him, and that man would be in prison right now. But even after all these years, 21 plus years, never been charged with the crime, never even been named publicly as a person of interest. So I think it's scarce. On the surface, maybe a bad guy, but all these people who have looked into this case haven't been able to find anything to connect him to it. And I think that means something. I think that's significant, and we shouldn't just skate over that, which causes us to transition to another theory. And this is where I'm going to have to come at Sandra a little bit. I talked about her at the top of the show. I'm going to talk about her here because I don't know if they had the best situation at home. It seems like Sandra was not making the best decisions as a parent, in my opinion. I would not be out on dates till 3:30 in the morning, leaving my 13-year-old and my twin 6-year-olds at home alone. I would not do it. I have no problem with her having a romantic life. She should be allowed to do that. But you plan it out a little better. You have someone come over and babysit. You maybe go out earlier in the day and maybe be home by a reasonable time to make sure your kids are in bed and they're okay. I'm definitely not coming home at 3:30 in the morning, staying for an hour, and then leaving again. And if I had to guess, and Sandra, you can correct me if I'm wrong, this probably wasn't the first time this happened. As I mentioned in the episode, according to her sisters, she was like a second mom and she spent a lot of time with them. I love that, and it makes me appreciate and respect Alex so much more, but it doesn't mean it's right. That's not her responsibility at 13 years old to be a second mother when there's already a mother there. That's my thoughts on Sandra in creating this environment that may have opened up the possibilities for this next theory that I'm going to talk about. I've worked a lot of cases. I've dealt with a lot of wayward children, disobedient children, people who were not in the best situation at home because of maybe some parental decisions and were allowed to get away with a lot. They were leaving the home without telling anyone, going out and having sex at a very young age, doing drugs. It never resulted in anything good. And normally when I found this child, I could pinpoint it back to the foundation of the home and they're just not being good parental figures to look up to and to keep them in line, keep them in check. And I think that's what was going on here. And so it's very possible, in my opinion, and this is nothing against Alex, that she may know this. She may know that she was home a lot, and this may have been a common pattern with Sandra. And so because of that, 13-year-old girl, she's filling that void when she's at home alone. She has no one to talk to. She realizes that there's no adult supervision. She's probably on maybe different forums, different websites. I don't know, AOL, AIM, whatever it is, MySpace, all those different things. Maybe in these chat rooms, and she's talking to a lot of people. Is it possible that she had talked to people that she may not have known personally yet, but interacted with them, maybe even met up with them in the past? I think it's possible. I do. I think there's a world where this young girl who doesn't have someone to really tell her that this is wrong is making decisions that she doesn't realize at the time that could put her in a lot of danger. So as I sit here and talk to you guys, is it unreasonable that maybe Alex had been interacting with someone online, maybe had been talking to them for multiple days or multiple months, maybe exchange photos, whatever it might be. And finally, because she knew her mom was not home often, decided after her mom left at 3:30 in the morning that she was either going to have someone come over or she was going to meet up with them and go for a quick ride and she'd be back before her mom ever returned. So this person gets the address, comes over, and either they come inside or Alex unlocks the door and goes out to the vehicle. And that is the vehicle that multiple witnesses have reported seeing with a white male driving it. Alex doesn't realize it at the time, but this person has completely different intentions than what she's there for. And that would explain what happened to her afterward. This was premeditated on the suspect's part. They knew exactly what they were going there to do. And this is a story that unfortunately we've heard before. I also want to go back to Rudy real quick, because this is just another indication that it wasn't him. And I didn't hit on this earlier. If it was Rudy and he did come inside, I don't believe that if Alex left, it would have been willingly. There would have been some sign of struggle inside the home. Blood, things knocked over, something to indicate Alex put up a fight before being removed from that home. And yet we don't have it. And if these witness statements are correct, Alex was in that car willingly. She was sitting in the passenger seat. Now, there is a world she could have been in there with a gun or a knife being held to her. There's no doubt about that. But to me, it makes more sense that that door was unlocked and she willingly left because she thought that the person she was going to be with was someone she could trust. And unfortunately, when she finally realized that wasn't the case, it was too late. And that's the investigator's worst case scenario. Because on one hand, it could be someone she knew, but the question is, how long? Days? Weeks? Had she ever met this person in person before? Those are the big questions. I don't think that she walked out of the house and some random stranger who she had never interacted with before is responsible for killing her. I do think this person was someone that she, at least in her mind, knew, quote unquote, knew and felt comfortable with. But I don't think this necessarily has to be a family member or friend or neighbor. It could be someone that she was just having a couple conversations with online. And so where does that leave us? Unfortunately, it's difficult because this is absolutely, like I just said, worst case scenario, because there may be nothing to reverse engineer. No connective tissue that ties this person to Alex or Sandra in the past. That's a problem. That makes this a very difficult case to solve. And then you consider the fact that it occurred in 2005. I always got to remind myself how long ago that really was. And like the iPhone wasn't a thing yet. I know we had, you know, AIM Instant Messenger, and I believe MySpace was out then. If I'm wrong, you guys can correct me. But there would have been an opportunity at that time to seize the computer, if they had one, and look at any web browsing history to see what website she was visiting and who she was interacting with. There would have also been an opportunity to go speak with her friends. There still is, by the way, to ask what behaviors they were displaying at school at that time. What mediums were they using to interact with each other? And were there any public forums that they were using to interact with new people that they didn't necessarily know? You'd also want to go and talk to her friends about any conversations they had had with her. Did Alex ever say in the past that she was interacting with people online or talking to boys who she thought she may have feelings for? These are conversations that investigators would need to have with anyone close to her. And then, of course, you'd want to go re-interview the neighbors who said that they saw her on the morning of August 13th. Now, many years have passed, but you would still want to grab photos of anybody in her life. Neighbors, friends, family members, Rudy. You'd want to put some photo arrays together, show them the photos, and see if they identify the person in one of those photos as the person they saw driving the vehicle on the morning of August 13th. And then the only other thing that crossed my mind was the possibility that maybe traffic cam footage was collected at that time as well. You have the bridge right there. I don't know how populated the area was or if there were traffic cameras, but hypothetically, if Rudy was involved and there were traffic cameras, maybe you would catch his vehicle on camera, just in case this red vehicle report is inaccurate. And then to go over to the DNA side of things, this is a difficult case. I've worked multiple cases where the victims have been found in bodies of water, and it's hard. Water is the ultimate enemy of DNA, and it makes things very difficult to process after the fact, and that's done intentionally in many cases. Suspects know this by this point. Water and DNA, they don't mix. It makes it tough, but you hope that there's something preserved in the water that can help you. In most cases, you would expect something like under the fingernails, but here we don't have those extremities to look at. But I do have some hope because apparently items were sent off for forensic testing, and maybe there was something there seen by someone who actually was boots on the ground, and they said, we got something here. Maybe we can use this to process it, and with the new advancements we have, actually extract something that's usable. And lastly, it always comes back to you guys. It comes back to the community, people from that area. You have to hope that whether it's a necklace you saw or someone you had spoken with in the past or someone who had displayed odd behavior before, during, or after what happened to Alex, that you thought about it at the time, didn't think much of it, and didn't report it, but now in hindsight, you wish you did. I'm here to tell you, it's not too late. So just to recap, 13-year-old Alex Anaya disappeared from her home in Hammond, Indiana during the early morning hours of August 13th, 2005. Just weeks later, on September 7th, investigators confirmed that the human remains found in the Little Calumet River near the Chicago and Riverdale border belonged to Alex. She had been raped, murdered, and dismembered. Despite years of investigation, no arrests have been made, and Alex's murder remains unsolved. If you have any information in Alex's case, you can call the FBI of Chicago at 312-421-6700. There is a $20,000 reward available. As always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Alex, including you, Sandra. I don't agree with the decisions you made, but as I said in the episode, you don't deserve this. Nobody deserves this. And we do make mistakes. Unfortunately, some have more significant consequences than others. But I'm here, I'm still rooting for you and your family, and I want you guys to get justice. You deserve it. And when you mentioned your twin daughters, I think about them and being only 6 years old at the time, but realizing later that they were home when whatever happened to Alex happened. And that would be something that would wear on me. So I think about them and I want to get justice for them so they finally have those answers. And as long as we continue sharing her story and not forgetting what happened to her, regardless of how many years passed, there's always hope that someone will come forward and do the right thing, or technology will catch up and we'll be able to use the evidence we do have to finally solve this case. I'm really hoping I get the opportunity to sit right here with all of you and let you know that that has happened and we have identified the monster responsible. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save.